right in, pull up a chair. It's time once again to gather around the gaming table with your friends at The Gaming Gang. Proudly sponsored by Victory Point Games. This time, Elliot will be reviewing Conquest of Narrath from Wizards of the Coast and Space Empires 4X from GMT Games. Jeff will be reviewing Keep Up the Fire from Victory Point Games and Son of York from GMT. We'll announce the winner of the TGG Birthday Bash Contest. We'll have news, views, and more on this episode of The Gaming Gang. Now here's your hosts, Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller.
Hi, I'm Jeff McAleer.
And I am Elliot Miller.
Welcome back. Oh, yeah.
Welcome back.
It has been a bit of a delay in getting the show up, actually getting it recorded. It took an additional 6 days for me to get my internet service set up at the new Mesa, Arizona studios. Hey, I figure if your closet can be the Villa Park studio, my apartment can be the Mesa, Arizona studio.
Oh, you get a whole apartment. I get a 3x3 closet.
You know, the funny thing is,
blankets on the walls.
My master, well, it's only a 1-bedroom apartment. It's got a really huge walk-in closet. And I thought for a fraction of a second that maybe what I could do is set it up as, you know, a recording studio. And then I thought, what, are you out of your mind? Where are you going to put your clothes?
Yes. Well, luckily, this is in my office, so my clothes are fine on the floor.
That's right. All balled up. This one smells clean. I'll put this shirt on. I've only worn it a couple of days in a row. It should still be all right. I don't perspire that much. So I am very glad to be in my new home. All these different things that I had been in the midst of doing, working on my grandfather's house. You know, he had passed away back in August. That's going to close hopefully this week. So I was doing some work on that. I was getting ready to move. I did the move. Then I had no internet. So I wanted to say to you, Elliot, thank you so much for really trying to stay on top of the website as much as you could.
Well, I did my best. So tired. I've had a heck of a week from work.
Oh,
so I got some stuff up.
And this is your super busy week. The first week of the month is always really busy for yourself. So, yep, I understand that. Anyway, enough jawing about ourselves. Let's announce the big winner of the Gaming Gang Birthday Bash Contest.
Wait a minute.
What?
Let's do that at the end of the show.
The end of the show? Why would we do that?
Because then everybody listening is just going to turn it off right now.
Yeah, but most people turn off the show at about this point anyway.
At least we'll force them to fast forward through the whole thing.
There you go. We'll force them to have to download the entire show. Sorry, you guys. You can't just stream the first 10 minutes and then you'll jump out. You got to let the whole file finish downloading. All right, that's fine. Yeah, we'll do that right at the end.
Cool.
We already have selected the winner. And we had over 1,000 entries.
Sweet.
So that was very, very cool. And we'll recap the games that are up for grabs anyway, too. So shall we move on to the news?
Yes, we shall.
Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. North and South America. All the ships and clippers at sea. Let's go to France, Flash.
Tree Frog Games' latest, A Few Acres of Snow, should be out in stores this week. It is being released through Mayfair Games, and it's designed by Martin Wallace. A Few Acres of Snow reenacts the struggles between Britain and France over control of Canada. Ha! And you thought it was going to be something along the lines of the French-Indian Wars, but no, it's not. Mm. Actually, it is. I'm kidding. A war fought at the edge of two mighty empires for over 150 years, Britain and France were locked in a struggle for domination of North America. Thousands of miles from their homes, settlers and soldiers were faced with impenetrable forests, unpredictable American tribes, and formidable distances. Despite these obstacles, they were able to engage in bitter warfare, with the British ultimately taking the prize of Quebec. Oh, great. I just gave away the end of the story.
Nice. Well, yeah. I'm not going to buy it now.
Now, I know how it ends. A Few Acres of Snow is a two-player game that allows you to recreate this contest. You can change the course of history by your decisions. A Few Acres of Snow takes an innovative approach to the subject using cards to represent locations and manpower. As the game progresses, you'll add to your selection of cards, increasing the range of actions available to you. There are many strategies to be explored. How quickly should you build up your forces? Do you employ Native Americans? And what energy should be expended on your economy? Will your deck recreate this historical event or change the course of history in just over an hour's time?
You know, I actually thought it was going to be about cupcakes because I misunderstood the title when I first heard it.
I thought it was about cocaine.
No, I thought it was a few bakers of dough.
See, I thought it was battling snowmen in a field.
That might be a good game, you know.
Anyway, A Few Acres of Snow should be on store shelves probably by the time you listen to this show.
The right way to kickstart. Empires of the Void. Now, a few months back, we talked about a game in development called Empires of the Void from Ryan Lucott.
We did?
Well, okay. I did a post about it.
I was going to say, this is all brand new to me.
Well, there you go.
Kidding. I just don't recall. That's all.
I don't recall, Senator.
I'll take the fifth.
I'll take a fifth of Jack. Ryan has formed Red Raven Games, and Empires of the Void is up for backing on Kickstarter through November 27th. Empires is a space empire slash conquest game in which 2 to 4 players battle for control over the galaxy. I love the galaxy. It's so great. The board is modular, so gameplay is different each time. Random event deck also ensures variations in gameplay. And I got a little better description for you, too. Empires of the Void is an epic space empire building game. Playable in 2 hours. The game is for 2 to 4 players and has an intuitive yet flexible rule system that allows for many different strategies. Players can win by conquering planets, using diplomacy, researching technology, or focusing on ruling the Galactic Council. Feel like ruling every planet you encounter with an iron fist? Want to outsmart your opponents with sneaky, underhanded maneuvers they don't expect?
Yes. Yes, yes.
Or perhaps you desire superior technology so you can outgun the competition.
I like
the sneaky part.
Yeah, I'll take that.
Empires of the Void has a heavy emphasis on theme and story. Each round starts with a random event to enhance the flavor of the setting. The game comes with 7 standard alien races to choose from, each with unique abilities and playstyles. There's also 15 additional neutral aliens to conquer or befriend, each with unique abilities and strengths. The variable board comes in 7 hexagonal pieces, so each game will be a different experience. It does look interesting, and I'm always on the lookout for a new sci-fi themed game.
And of course, they said heavy theme, so right there, I know your heart's pounding a little faster.
Backers of the Kickstarter project will receive an extra alien race for a total of 8 races to pick from when playing Empires of the Void.
So you're saying that people can sponsor that Kickstarter project, you said, till November 27th? Was that correct?
That is correct, sir.
Very good. Very good. Cool. Mini or not, we'll be bringing a 6-hour 2-DVD set with Jennifer Haley's secrets behind painting miniatures.
What?
It's, yeah. What are you saying what for?
Is she a big miniatures painter expert?
I suppose. Well, she wouldn't have a DVD if she wasn't.
That's right. You know, I don't run in the miniature painter circles.
Well, this 2-DVD set is going to be recommended for intermediate to advanced miniature painters. So someone like yourself may not necessarily want to pick it up. Although, to be honest, basic painting skills aren't that difficult. You're going to find out about the following techniques like miniature preparation, color theory, composition, faces and eyes, skin tones, and clothing and armor. This 2-DVD set should arrive in stores this month, so it should be something pretty interesting to check out. I'd like to check it out myself. I'm finally going to be able to do a little more painting to continue my little series that I started, a year ago?
Yeah.
I think my last post was like 6 months back. Nah, it's not that far back, but still, it's been a while.
Yeah, if only I had my Mansions of Madness figures painted. So.
Oh, you know what? I hate to break it to you, and I hate to break it to you publicly like this, but they were all destroyed in the move.
What?
Yeah, they were all busted. I love it. You're like, what?
I'd crush them underneath a box of
Well,
bricks I was carrying.
I jumped all up and down on the box.
Yeah, it would have been nice to have them for the Miller Gaming Weekend.
Well, I could send you the four monsters I've got completed already.
No, that's cool. Ares Games announces Sales of Glory. Ares Games, the game publisher of the Wings of Glory series of aerial combat games, announces a new game based upon that popular game system, with a completely new setting. The game, to be called Sails of Glory, will recreate naval warfare in the Age of Sail, 1650 to 1815. The Wings of Glory game system will be modified and expanded to represent accurately battles at sea between large sailing ships of the past centuries. Created by Andrea Angelino and Andrea Mannanini. Created by two guys
from Italy.
From Italy. Sales of Glory.
Who have, with names that are almost unpronounceable to we American blokes.
Sales of Glory will merge miniatures, cards, and board game mechanics using the same intuitive system of Wings of Glory, which features a special deck of maneuver cards to represent the different movement capabilities of each model. The game will be supported by a range of painted and assembled 1/1200 miniatures.
1/1200.
Thank you. The first series of Sales of Glory, scheduled to be released in summer 2012, will be set in the Napoleonic Age. If the game is successful, in the future it will be extended to cover other historical periods, such as the...
And if it's not successful, those will be the only miniatures ever available for the game.
Yes, I'm sure that goes without saying. Such as the Age of Discovery, the Middle Ages, and Ancient Times. Sounds interesting. I did like Wings of Glory.
I enjoy naval miniatures myself.
Well, of course.
So, yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So I'll be on the lookout for that. That's pretty cool. Although I'm kind of curious how they would adapt the Wings of Glory mechanics to that. But I guess we'll find out.
I guess so.
Days of Wonder is releasing a free mini expansion for Small World. Because they've been trying to come up with a system to connect Small World and Small World Underground.
Yeah, in a better way, without the fiddliness.
It's going to be tunnels. No, it's just called tunnels, Small World tunnels. Mm-hmm. Players use caverns as tunnel entrances to jump between the two worlds as they deploy the races and special powers from both games. By connecting the two worlds, this expansion also makes the races and special powers from above and below ground more universally compatible. It'll enable 2 to 6 players in various combinations of both game boards with a simple setup described in the rules booklet. It's recommended for experienced Small World players, and of course you're going to need both Small World and Small World Underground to play. It's going to make its debut at Essen, and should be in stores in mid-November 2011. And it's, as I said, going to be free. So make sure your friendly local game store holds onto a copy for you. And people who don't have both games don't go in there and just swipe them, grab them all up and be like, I got Small World tunnels. You don't.
Sell it on eBay.
Oh, yeah, obviously. Once they're all gone, sure. Can't you just see it? Somebody who doesn't own any games, they just happen to make games. Oh, that's free? Yeah, I'll take that. Sure.
Sounds interesting, mm-hmm. But I'm kind of wondering how they're going to do it, you know, because it doesn't seem like it'll be really that small of a world anymore.
I don't know. Mid-sized world? Don't know.
Gen X Games will be releasing a game at Spiel 2011 based on a theme that would not have occurred to me in a million years. It's the acquisition and management of a collection of historical aircraft and gaining prestige showing them off in an air show. So the game is called Air Show.
Da, 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 da.
Air Show is a game about the creation and management of collections and museums of historic aircraft, which are kept in perfect flying condition for display to the public and reliving the history of aviation. The aircraft represented in the game are all real, and they are all aircraft that are currently part of collections and museums in different countries are in the antiques market for sale. With Airshow, you can create, develop, maintain, and manage an impressive collection of valuable historical aircraft in flight status. You will participate in exciting auctions, trying to acquire more aircraft for your collection in fierce competition with other collectors. managing your resources, you can develop your base airport, acquire new buildings, and hire professional experts to improve your exhibitions. Perform spectacular air shows with your planes, earning the prestige and money you need to continue your progress. At the end of the game, the player who has the largest collection, the best managed, and who has made the best air shows will be the air show winner. It actually sounds kind of interesting.
Welcome back, my friend, to the air show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Take a ride, take a ride.
Yeah, I would have never thought of that. If it didn't have, you know, I'm not big on the auction mechanic.
Me either. You know,
but other than that, it's kind of intriguing. I would have never thought of
Well, it's certainly a theme that I don't think has been covered really in the past.
The Screwbolt Assembly Game.
Another one? I am so tired of Screwbolt Assembly Games. Man. Hunter's Books has announced two upcoming supplements for the Outbreak Undead role-playing game. Undead Annual 2010-2011 and Wild Kingdom. Although I don't know if Wild Kingdom is going to feature, what was that old guy's name on it?
I knew you were going to say that.
It's at the tip of my tongue. Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom.
With the old guy.
Marlon Perkins?
Was it Marlon Perkins?
Does that sound familiar? Yeah, I think so. And I remember as a kid, they used to have that show on, and he never did anything. It was always this other, right. I forget the guy's name. Jack's going to go out there and he's going to jump in the middle of these five gorillas.
Oh, God. Oh.
Yeah. Outbreak Wild Kingdom is going to showcase the wilder side of the zombie apocalypse with a focus on wilderness survival. Wild Kingdom features an expanded bestiary with in-depth guides for using and creating your own zombie beasts. Plus new character types, skills, equipment, strongholds, and missions, as well as expanded environment rules and a sample campaign. The Outbreak Undead Annual is going to feature an entire year's worth of free content Friday that came out for Outbreak Undead, including additional missions, scenarios, and game aids conveniently tucked into one single manual. So you should be able to see these two compilations coming out very soon. And I will be having a review of Outbreak Undead probably within the next week or so.
Cool.
Yes, I'm not going to give anything away, but I think, hey, it's October. It is a good time for us to talk about horror games. And I'm thinking what we might do on our next show is talk about our favorite horror games just in time for Halloween.
Oh, you know what? I was going to actually mention some of my favorite horror podcasts.
We'll talk about our favorite horror games, and you can talk about horror podcasts.
I just want to throw out a couple of recommendations. That's it. I see nothing. Stalag 17 from Gen X Games. Also coming to Spiel 2011 from Gen X Games is Stalag 17.
Did you get like a payoff from Gen X Games?
It's only two.
Did you get a check that I don't know about?
I know nothing.
When you did that, I thought, what is this, a Hogan's Heroes game? Hogan!
A game where each player represents a group of prisoners attempting to escape from the Nazi Stalag 17 POW camp. It's a game for 2 to 5 players and takes less than an hour to play. Gen X Game says, the prisoners of Stalag 17 have only one thing in mind, escape. With a good plan, the necessary tools, and an excellent knowledge of the area, you will be able to get out of there. But beware. Inmates from other countries are also trying to escape, and as soon as one of them does, the guards will tighten their security both in the cells and with the soldiers themselves. They will confiscate everything that might have been put aside and increase surveillance of those who have been found with items forbidden in Stalag 17, making it virtually impossible to escape. Use the guard to help you get rid of things you cannot use. Hide the items that might help you, and do not wait too long. I've heard the guys from the other barrack are planning their escape for tonight.
You did? Who told you that?
I know nothing.
You know, interestingly enough, Hogan's Heroes, you do remember the guy who played the, what was it, Frenchie? Or I forget what his character name was, but he was the French POW.
Yeah, the guy from Family Feud? Richard Dawson?
No, Richard Dawson was the English guy. Now, I can't remember the actor's name. He was actually a concentration camp survivor.
Well, I never knew that.
Yes. In fact, he came to our high school and gave a talk. Maybe you were cutting class that day or something. I think it was our freshman year, so I highly doubt that would have been the case. I remember someone had even asked him, or he had talked about it. You got to realize this is, 30 years ago. Yeah. But they were asking him, being a concentration camp survivor, how he felt about being in a show that was effectively a comedy with Nazis. I'll never forget it. He had said, hey, you know, it was a job. Yeah. You know, he had a family, and it's not like he really appreciated it a whole lot, but you got to work. And when you're an actor, yeah, what can you do? So, yeah, I thought that was kind of strange.
Huh.
I see nothing. Yeah, it just popped in my head. Wizards of the Coast is going to release their third Dungeons & Dragons board game. The Legend of Drizzt, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, is a cooperative game, is going to be based on the best-selling books. The Adventures of Drizzt Do'Urden, or whatever, as told in the New York Times best-selling Forgotten Realms novels by R.A. Salvatore, come to life in this thrilling board game. Take on the role of the legendary Drow Ranger or one of his famous adventuring companions. Battle fearsome foes and win treasure and glory.
I prefer
the treasure. Yeah, you can keep the glory. I just want the treasure.
Buy glory.
It's designed for 1 to 5 players and features multiple scenarios, challenging quests, and cooperative gameplay. The contents can also be combined with other D&D adventure system games like Castle Ravenloft and Wrath of Ashardalon.
So this would actually make this the fourth.
No, it's the third.
What about Conquest of Narrath, which I'm going to review in this very episode?
That is not considered one of their board games as far as with individual figures, with, you know, individual characters. Narrath big, like almost like Risk kind of game?
Of course, I believe people consider Risk a board game. But, you know, maybe I'm crazy. I don't know.
Dude, I'm just telling you. That's what Wizards of the Coast is saying, man. That's all I can tell you.
Just...
It's also going to feature some competitive aspects and mechanics to it as well, so you can battle other players, and you should be seeing this in just a few weeks.
Nice.
It looks like it's got quite a few figures there. I was painting up the Castle Ravenloft ones.
Were you?
So, yeah. Not now. I'm too busy working on your Mansions of Madness ones.
All right, then.
I have a bunch of Reaper stuff that I need to... I've started doing some of the base stuff on it.
Yeah.
But I had to put all that on the side so I could get your Mansions of Madness stuff out. But I'm going to have some Reaper minis reviews. And to me, it doesn't make any sense to review miniatures unpainted. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah, this looks like this will paint up nice. Well, maybe. Maybe not.
It's like reviewing
a
print and play.
Anyway, talking about this Legend of Drizzt, have you ever read any of the Dungeons & Dragons novels or anything like that in your life?
I don't remember. I don't think so. Maybe some of the Forgotten Realms way back when.
I know I never have. It's funny, and I'm sure this isn't the case, but I just think to myself, and then Drizzt was walking down this dark, dank corridor and rolled a die 20.
You know,
like
that kind of...
Like the story stops for like his rolls and stuff. Yeah.
You know, that kind of sounds interesting because you've heard of Tales of the Arabian Nights, right?
Yes.
A D&D version of Tales of the Arabian Nights, huh? Wizards of the Coast, are you listening? Might be a good plan.
I've never played Tales of the Arabian Nights.
I haven't either. I've heard a lot about it and I've seen a lot of reviews about it. And so I know how it works. And it's, you know, basically a big book and you all go through an adventure.
Right.
And
remember how they used to have them all the time where it's like, create your own adventure books.
Yeah. Choose your own adventure.
Exactly. Yeah, that's it. That's
what it
was.
I used to have a bunch
of
those.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice. Very nice. Any more news?
Available from retailers right now.
If I go out to the store right now, even though they're closed, I could break in and get
this? Yes, you could. As long as it's still there.
Okay.
Is Arcana Revised Edition from Fantasy Flight Games. Arcana is a card game of intrigue, bribery, and coercion for 2 to 4 players. Can your guild claim control of the infamous city, or will you be left yearning for power? With new guilds and new optional rules, the revised edition of Arcana will enhance the game's strategic options. In this intriguing card game, you lead one of six unique guilds, initiates of an exclusive arcanum of power in Cadwallon, of City of Thieves fame, vying for domination of the city districts. Send your agents to secure the aid of influential citizens and gain precious relics in your quest for ultimate authority. The guild with the most victory points wins! Now, the revised edition of Arcana offers players two new guilds to lead, the Guild of Fortune Tellers and the Guild of Architects. Are your chosen agents clairvoyant experts, gathering influence through sorcery? Or perhaps you call to action passionate craftsmen, engineers who work with stone, metal, and naphtha. Yes, naphtha.
NAFTA? The North American
Free Trade Agreement?
Yes. Yeah, huh?
We try to work with it, you know?
I didn't know it was in the game.
With the addition of guild choices, the revised edition of Arcana offers players a new experience with each pick of the cards. Arcana's new playing variants also increase its replayability. There are six new rule options for players to choose from, or you can play with them all for a more challenging experience. Players can customize their guild, fulfill objectives, recruit militia, invoke the ability of their guildmasters, affect gameplay through random events, or optimize tactical strategy through card discards, and it is available now.
Isn't that a Dust title?
I believe it is.
I think so, too.
Asmodee Editions is releasing Timeline, and that should be arriving in stores very shortly as well. Was the light bulb invented after or before glasses? Obviously after. Oh, crap. I just gave the whole game away. Oh, well.
Only one question.
Any other news? No, kidding. With Timeline, learn the answer to this question and thousands of others by comparing your knowledge or hunches to historic reality. At the beginning of the game, players all get the same number of cards representing monuments, inventions, etc. On the back of each card is a date. To begin, one card's randomly drawn from those not given to the players. This is placed in the middle of the table, the date side up, and is the starting point of a chronological line which will slowly be built by players. The first player then chooses one of their cards. If the player thinks that invention on their card came before that of the initial card, they'll place it to the left. If they think it happened afterwards, they'll place it on the right. If the player is correct, it'll remain on the table. Otherwise, the card's discarded and a new one has to be drawn to replace it. Then play will proceed clockwise. The more cards that are correctly played, the harder it is going to be to correctly place new ones. The first player to get rid of all of their cards wins. What if you just took all your cards and threw them in the trash?
You win!
I win! I am a winner! Winning!
Winning! You know that's the most popular costume this Halloween.
Yep. Charlie Sheen? Sure really? Is. Do you have to drink tiger piss?
You don't have to, but, you know, it's a personal choice.
I guarantee people will be carrying around bottles with some yellow liquid in it with a little thing that says tiger piss on it. You don't mind if I say piss, do you? You can say that on TV.
You can say a lot of crap on TV.
Timeline sounds like it could be a fun little game. My understanding is for 2 to 8 players. Oh,
very good.
And it seems like it's going to come in like a metal tin, so you can kind of take it wherever you want. So, yeah, I'd like to check that out. It just seems like it'd be a pretty interesting little filler game, I suppose.
It's kind of like a little party game.
I don't know if I'd call it a party game. It doesn't strike me as one of those that you would, well, I guess
like
you could. I don't know. Wits and Wagers just seems like, well, I guess I can't really say anything because we haven't seen this game. We've played Wits and Wagers, so yeah. I just don't have the impression that it would import over to a party atmosphere as well, where you could have teams.
Right.
And in the last piece of news, on Saturday, October 22nd at 12 noon, the Victory Point Games offices are open for gaming as usual, but you're going to have some very special guests. You'll be able to meet designers Tom Decker, who created Circus Train and Disaster on Everest, war game designer Lance McMillan, Star Borders Humanity, Dresden 20, many of the Napoleonic's 20 line, designer Chris Taylor, our friend who created Nemo's Wharf, Forlorn Hope, and Legions of Darkness, and Hans von Stockhausen, who did The Lost Cause, which I don't think Elliot has yet been able to beat. Terry Coleman's going to be there, who's designed TC Tennis, and Nathan Hansen, who is behind the Battle of Four Armies. And, of course, the man behind Victory Point Games, Alan Emmerich. They're all going to be there for that weekend only. So if you're in California or happen to be in California on that weekend, definitely stop in. It's absolutely free. You'll get to play test some new games and check out some other games that Victory Point Games has available, because I think they've got, 180 games all in all. I wish I could be there, but unfortunately, I will not. Although, I will say right here, before the end of the year is up. Okay, I can't say before the end of the year. Before next spring, I am going to go to California and visit the Victory Point Games headquarters.
Hey, and that just reminds me, our next podcast will be delayed too. Because I will be attending Arkham Knights 2011. I didn't think I was going to be able to go, but looks like I will be able to. And that will be in 2 weekends.
And now it's time for the Gaming Gang's game review. Let's try saying that 10 times fast.
I'm not going to try.
All right, so first up we have
Conquest of Narath from Wizards of the Coast, published in 2011 and designed by Richard Baker. For 2 to 4 players ages 12 and up.
It's designed by the guy who was R2-D2?
No, that was Kenny Baker.
Oh, sorry. It's the Baker name. You mean it's the guy who played Doctor Who?
No.
You mean the guy who was our Secretary of State?
Conquest of Narath is a military conquest game along the lines of Risk or Axis and Allies. It has its own differences that make it unique, and we'll go over those. It boils down to individual taste. Some of you will love the game and some will not. I'll attempt to help you make that decision for yourself.
Please
do. This is a game based on the Dungeons & Dragons universe. Why? Because it's from Wizards of the Coast. So it's a fantasy setting with monsters, heroes, and the undead. The players' pieces are divided among the territories on the board, and the players compete for control of the board. In the longest version of the game, the last player standing wins. And it does take a long time. And once you've eliminated another player, they're out for good, and might as well go watch TV or something. There are also 2 other versions you can play with the goal of reaching a certain number of victory points. You gain 1 victory point for each enemy territory you conquer, and those games are a lot shorter, but will still typically take about 2 hours to complete. The components of the game are excellent.
Excellent.
The board and the artwork are spectacular, and there are several hundred miniatures included in 4 different player colors. In addition to the 10 different categories of pieces like the wizard, the castle, the siege weapon, there are several pieces that have different molds for each player. The foot soldiers, fighters, dragons, and monsters are unique for each player's nation they represent. There's a handful of dice of different sizes in classic D&D style, but unfortunately, the game could have used a couple more, especially the 20-siders, as that's the die used by the dragons, which are, of course, pretty popular. And there's only 1 20-sider included, but yeah, I got a few of those laying around.
Well, I was going to say, too, and that's not a die that comes with a lot of different games.
Wizards of the Coast games, they do.
Yes, I understand that. Most people who have loads and loads of games, if they're not necessarily a role player, they may not
have
a lot of 20-siders laying
around. Passing the 20-sider around. Whereas most of the other dice, they didn't have to do that. There was enough of them. There's also cards, tokens, mini poker chips, and 1 player aid card for each player. Player aid cards could have used some more work. They could have been much more useful. You'll find yourself referring to the rulebook quite often, as you won't have the info right in front of you where you need it. Purchasing new pieces for your armies require you to refer to the chart on the back of the rulebook quite often, so your best bet is to make a copy of this page and hand out 1 to each player. This is an oversight that could have been avoided. Initial setup does take some time, as there's a lot of pieces to place on the board, and it's easy to make mistakes. The bases of the figures have different shapes to aid you in identifying which is which. So, for example, the foot soldiers all have square bases. And this does help a lot. You'll set up the board the same way each time you play. So basically each territory has little pictures of the figures that go on, you know, right on the board.
Mm-hmm. Sure, right. Starting forces, yeah.
This does lead to one of my biggest problems with the game and will help you decide whether you either like it or not. You can play either a free-for-all game with all players competing against each other or an alliance game where two nations take on the other two nations. In a two-player game, it's easy. One player takes Kharkov and the Iron Circle, while the other player takes Valen and Narath. In a three-player game, one player has to play two of the nations, while the other two players get one each. And, of course, in a four-player game, each player gets one. So all four nations must play each game, regardless of the number of players. Downtime is a problem in the three- and four-player games, but not any more than you would typically run across playing something like Risk. To me, the sweet spot is two players, but you're controlling and keeping track of two separate nations, so it's easy to forget to use the cards you have for each nation. The four-player game's not bad, as you each control just one nation, but the downtime between turns can get a little tiresome. The three-player game I didn't enjoy, as one player is controlling two nations, so they're taking twice the amount of turns as the other players, and the other players have a longer wait between their turns. There are those who will not mind the downtime, especially the strategic players who like to keep an eye on what the other players are doing, which is always a good idea. This helps eliminate the long wait and keeps you involved and makes it an enjoyable game. If you have these types of players, I think you'll have a great time playing Conquest of Narath. After setup, players begin the conquest. The movement and the battles are really simple. Each piece has its own movement rate shown on the chart on the back of the book. It's basically one, two, or three territories a turn. If you move pieces into an enemy's territory, then combat will occur, but not until you finish moving all of your pieces first. Each piece has its own die that it rolls to attack, and a roll of a 6 or higher is a hit. So a foot soldier will roll a 6-sider, a fighter rolls a 10-sider, and the dragon gets to roll a 20-sider, etc. If you have problems remembering which die to roll for each unit, well, just look at the base. Most of the units have bases shaped like one side of the die that you roll. So, as you know, the foot soldier has a square base, so you roll a 6-sider, and so on. Each piece can take one hit, except for the dragons, which can take two. You simply flip it upside down to indicate that it's been damaged. Battle continues until either the attacker retreats, or one side or the other is eliminated. If the attacker wins, they earn a victory point and place a conquest token on the space. This is now their territory and will remain so until retaken by another player. Even if they lose the territory, that victory point still counts. There's cards, a separate deck for each player, which is pretty cool. They have effects like providing bonuses during battle or providing extra pieces to place on the board. You also earn an income of 1 gold per territory you control each turn. This gold can be spent to purchase additional units to add to your army as it sweeps the path of destruction across the landscape. There are lots of figures included. It would have been nice if a few more dragons and castles were provided. There's not quite enough of those. The board does get a bit crowded, and the battles can become a flusterclog.
What?
I found it easier to move the figures involved in the battle off the board and fight it out and then move the winners back when it was over, because you can have so many little figures in this little space. That aside from sense. The battles, there's also dungeons marked on the map. And now this is one of the innovations for this game. There are territories that have special door-shaped tokens placed on them. And a player can send his fighters and wizards into these territories to face the dungeon guardian. So what you do is you flip over the token, and the reverse side lists the monsters that are guarding the dungeon. You fight a battle against the guardian, and if you survive, you get to claim a treasure card. The treasure cards can come in pretty handy, and they provide a much-needed victory point boost. But be warned, the monsters in the dungeon can be pretty tough, and you're better off sending in several heroes rather than just one or two. To break it down, during each turn, a player needs to draw a card, move their pieces, fight their battles, purchase and move new units, and collect their income. Player turn order is predetermined, depending on which nation you're playing, and it's the same in every game. So if you're looking for a ramped-up Fantasy Risk or Axis and Allies-type conquest game with a lot of D&D flair, then this is the game for you. If the things that I mentioned earlier are too annoying for you, then you might want to think twice.
I have a couple of questions.
Talk to me.
First off, I'm talking to you. I'm asking away. You're talking about Risk and Axis and Allies. And the learning curve, the scale of those games as far as the detail in that are night and day. Is it closer to Risk or is it closer to Axis and Allies? Because Axis and Allies can actually be a relatively complex game for very casual gamers, whereas Risk is sort of, hey, come on, guys, let's crack some beers and play some Risk.
Well, I definitely think it's somewhere in between. I mean, it's definitely more complicated than Risk.
Okay.
And there's a lot more involved. There's about 10 different units types for each player. But really, the rules are not that complex, but there is some depth there because you get to do some different things. It's just all the pieces have, you know, one hit. They'll take one hit, so it's not too hard to figure that out. You move from one territory to the other. So it's definitely not as complex as Axis and Allies. It's a world conquest game, similar in that way.
In that vein, right. And it just has a kind of that feel. Okay, because there are lots of games
that I think it was really hugely complex to figure out.
Okay, that's why I was kind of curious if the level of detail was fairly high or was it – so it's middle of the road. Now, the second question I had is you were talking about downtime. You talked about with three players, one player's taking on two nations. Are these nations all pretty much equal sizes? So wouldn't you think that one player who has those two nations really has an advantage and basically those other two players have to gang up on
them? Well, that's the way it works, is the other two players are allied against the one player.
Got it. It just seems to me like that would be an unfair advantage to that player taking on the two countries because he can kind of coordinate things much better than the other two players would. But as far as downtime, how much downtime are we talking about?
It depends.
I mean, is it pretty substantial?
Once you know the game, it does start to go a little faster, but you do have to sit there and move each of your pieces and keep track of whether each of your pieces has moved. And then you have to fight your battles. Mm-hmm. And then and of course, another player is involved when you're fighting your battles, but only one player at a time. Then you get to collect your income and then spend your money to buy new pieces and then place those new pieces. And then you get to move those new pieces again. So it does take a few minutes for each of your turns. Once you're great at it, you'll probably fly through it. But like for a four-player game, you are going to have some downtime unless you're fighting a battle. If a person gets analysis paralysis, where they're trying to calculate all kinds of moves to make, it could take forever for them to go. And by that time, you know, the kids got their phones out and are texting and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah. Hey,
but, you know, if you're playing with people who
are
actually paying attention to the game and like to plan their strategies ahead of time, and then it's a good game.
Well, I would think a game like this would also sort of demand that that's the kind of player who's going to enjoy it. A strategy game is not for someone who cannot focus on a game.
There you go.
Obviously, I would hope that anybody who has extreme ADD or something like that is not going to say, oh, wow, sweet, man, I want to sit down. I want to play Third Reich from Avalon Hill. Oh, okay. Well, let me go get the pistol and put it in my mouth. Most people who would be drawn to this game are going to be people who would sit and pay attention to what their opponent is doing. Because if you don't, I would think that's a sure recipe for disaster.
What I'm saying is it's more of a gamer's strategy type game than, say, like a family game.
You know me. I like big, epic games.
That's true.
Love them. Love them, love them, love them.
Oh, and you know, there was one more thing that I was going to mention that I forgot about, which is unusual because I seem to mention it every time, is that the storage solution for Conquest of Narrath is probably one of the best I've ever seen.
Really?
Yes. They have one of those vacuum plastic inserts that fits everything all nicely. You can turn the game upside down. You can put it on its side and nothing falls out. It's really good.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Very cool. Yeah, I know you have this weird storage fetish. So,
yep.
My first review is going to be Keep Up the Fire from our friends at Victory Point Games. Designed by John Welsh, just released, a couple of months ago. It's a solitaire game. Although there are notations in it that you could play with more players, it's for ages 10 and up, and the playing time, according to Victory Point Games, is 55 minutes at Peking. Once you realize what exactly the setting of the game is, then you'll get that joke.
All right, I'm waiting for it.
No, I'm not going to. I'm going to leave you in the dark. It's been a while since we tackled a Victory Point game release. And I'm happy to say the latest title to hit the table is from our friend John Welsh. I don't want to jump too far off topic, but one of the reasons I enjoy playing games from Victory Point isn't only because Ellie and I think the vast majority of their titles are great, but also because of the really good people who are behind the scenes at the little company that could. There are a lot of really crappy games out there that are produced by really great people, and there are plenty of excellent games designed by folks who wouldn't piss on you if you were on fire. There are designers out there who you would not want to sit and play a game with. It's the truth. Most gamers don't realize it because they don't deal with these kind of people. Don't get me wrong, the vast majority of the people involved in the industry are great. I mean, they're excellent to work with. I'm happy to say that Victory Point Games is one of those companies where really great people are making really good games. And they're not alone in this fact. We deal with a lot of companies who are just awesome. They're amazing. Yet, as I mentioned, there's some producers out there that we don't deal with, nor do we mention their games any longer because they aren't very nice, or they run you around at conventions promising interviews and continue to blow you off. But that's a story for another day. I'm talking about cool people. John Welsh is definitely one of the good guys in the hobby, and I had an opportunity to spend a lot of time chatting with him, hanging out with him at the ConSim World Expo that was here last year. Now, that isn't saying I'm not going to take critical eye to his latest design, Keep Up the Fire. Victory Point Games likes to bring us, from time to time, games that focus on some of the more obscure moments in history. Granted, the Boxer Rebellion certainly isn't as obscure a topic as the Aaron Burr conspiracy, as dealt with in Hero of Weehawken, but it isn't on the top of many people's minds or on the tip of their tongues either. For those unfamiliar with the Boxer Uprising, as it's also known, suffice to say that in the waning years of the 19th century and the very beginning of the 20th, many Chinese weren't all too happy with the influx of foreigners making an impression on their way of life. The Society of Righteous and Harmonious Fists was a nationalist movement of those who wanted to drive the foreign devils out of China. Otherwise known as the Boxers, these people felt that too much influence was being meted out by these outsiders, and they didn't want to see a westernization of their homeland, nor be a victim of imperialist aims. Add in the fact the Boxers hated missionaries spreading Christianity throughout the land, and it's pretty plain to see that things were going to boil over at some point. In June of 1900, in Peking, which is modern-day Beijing, Boxer fighters threatened all foreigners and forced them to seek refuge in the legation quarter. In response, the initially hesitant Emperor Dowager, urged by the conservatives of the imperial court, supported the Boxers and declared war on foreign powers. With this, all hell broke loose all across China as foreigners and Christians, especially Chinese Christians, were massacred. Diplomats, foreign civilians and soldiers, and Chinese Christians moved into the legation quarter of the city. The legations, the UK, France, Germany, Italy, Austria-Hungary, Spain, Belgium, the Netherlands, the US, Russia, and Japan were ordered to leave the Chinese mainland, but following the murder of German envoy Clemens Freiherr von Ketteler in an open street, the legations decided to defy the Empress's order. At that point, the Imperial Army of China and the Boxers laid siege. The only hope in breaking the siege and saving the legations was more than 100 miles away. A release force known as the Eight Nation Alliance, under the command of British Lieutenant General Alfred Gaselee. Keep Up the Fire uses the Victory Point Games States of Siege system and puts you not only in command of the multinational force surrounded in Peking, but also the relief column of the Eight Nation Alliance fighting its way to lift the siege. All in all, your back is to the wall, as we've come to expect from every States of Siege title. As usual, the components are fairly typical of recent Victory Point releases. As I've mentioned previously, it really looks like VPG has raised their game a bit in the sharpness of the graphics as of late, and Tim Allen has once again done a fine job. Keep Up the Fire is small enough to take with you on the go as well, so you can pop it out and game just about anywhere you find yourself. of no surprise should be the set of cards which drives all the game action, as this is one of the main components of an SOS title. Not only do the cards provide the actions available to the player, but also provide additional historical info to provide for a narrative flow. Once again, I provide my 2 cents and recommend sleeving the cards for ease of play. Correct, Elliot Miller?
Yes, definitely.
Yes. Always sleeve your VPG cards. There's quite a few different companies out there that have the penny sleeves. They consider the small Euro game card, and you can get about 100 of them for like a buck or two. So it's not expensive at all. You recall I just mentioned you're in charge of not only the legations in Peking, but also the rescue force making its way to the city.
I am.
Yes, I'm sure you remember that. With this, you'll find that the action cards provide what commands can be used for the forces inside Peking, followed by what's available to the relief column. In the legation phase, you'll randomly place Chinese forces on the outskirts of Peking. At this point, the player is going to attempt to destroy these forces, which is no easy feat, as the Chinese army and boxers advance on the legation quarter. All the while, you'll see the strength of your defenders whittled away while the attackers just keep coming. It's best to do all you can to knock out the enemy from long range, as hand-to-hand fighting is just as devastating for the defender as it is for the attacker. In the relief column phase, you'll look to build up the column and face assaults from the natives as you try to make your way to Peking. It's important to note that logistics come into play, as you can't just make a mad dash for the city, but need to prepare and bolster your force. As in all States of Siege titles, there's always a lot more that needs to be done than you have actions available to you. The luck of a single die roll can be crucial and can turn what is shaping up to be a victory into a devastating defeat. I know a lot of people have a problem with that, where the entire game could turn on one roll of the die. There are more ways, of course, to lose the game than to win, as holding out until the relief force arrives is your only path to victory, while allowing the Chinese to reach Fort Holiday inside the legation quarter, having your forces in Peking eliminated, or not getting the column to Peking are all instant losses. Players may feel that the odds are stacked against them, and since this is a SOS title, they pretty much are. As with any solitaire game, much of the enjoyment is in the tension of make or break rolls to see if your defenders can hold out just long enough for the Lieutenant General to arrive. The reliance of so many die rolls effectively meaning a win or a loss might really be a turnoff, but keep up the fireplace quickly enough where you can just brush yourself off and have another go if you lose. I do like Keep Up the Fire, but there are a couple of minor issues that I have with the game. First, and I'll be honest, this is very minor, is the fact that it's mentioned that the game can be played by more than one person. In this scenario, one player commands the defense inside Peking, while the other commands the relief column. I have to be honest and say that I can't imagine playing with any of my friends, simply because there just wouldn't be enough for anyone to do controlling one of the two forces. It just wouldn't be interesting. In other words, as a solo venture, the game works, but I think it would be a snore fest for two or more players, because there's even an option where each player would be able to handle each of the legations. Maybe in a classroom environment, that might be something you would look at, but as a gamer, I highly doubt it. Second, the difficulty of getting the relief column to Peking, in my opinion, is pretty skewed. I didn't think it was very historically accurate. Obviously, this is a game, and it wouldn't be much of a challenge if Gasly's troops were able to reach Peking with any ease. Yet, historically, from what I understood, the Chinese army and boxers put up very little resistance, and what they did was easily pushed aside, and the term a hot knife through butter would come to mind. Now, John Welsh did comment on my written review of Keep Up the Fire, and I'll be the first one to point out, I am in no way an expert on the Boxer Rebellion. It was just my understanding that it was much easier to get the column there than John has pointed out in his comments that no, it actually wasn't necessarily that they were having to battle their way continuously to get there. It was more the logistics were very difficult. I also understand that the relief column aspect of the design brings a new wrinkle, as opposed to just having the Peking defenders hold out for X number of turns, but there's something about it that just doesn't quite ring true. Like I said, not a huge issue, and John has pointed out that my understanding is probably not the best of the Boxer Rebellion, but still. I'm just saying, as someone who's playing the game, it just seems as if it's a little too tough to get that column there. In the end, I like Keep Up the Fire. I think it's a worthy addition to the States of Siege line. I can't say it's the best in the series, because that's a tight race between Dawn of the Zeds and We Must Tell the Emperor, but it is certainly worth picking up. The theme is interesting, it's very rarely covered in a game, it plays well, and it has loads of tension to keep you coming back for more. I would have to say that if John's listening, and if John's mom's listening, John Welsh's mom should be proud. Kind of a joke, if you recall the interview that I did with all the guys from Victory Point Games. We were kidding around that the only people who would listen to the show would be one person and John's mom. Which is funny, because our most popular podcast we have ever done is the special we did with Victory Point Games.
You did. Right?
No. Well, it's us. Oh, yeah, I don't even listen to yours. I don't even let that file finish downloading to stream it. I'm like, no, I'm done.
I'm done.
I listen to make sure you got the music right, and that's
ba-bum,
all.
Ba-bum. You know, you did bring up an interesting point about the luck aspect and solitaire games. Right. I don't really think you could have a solitaire game without the luck aspect in it. I guess you can, like a purely mental game, like you're playing something like, what, Sudoku? Is that even a game? But for a game like this, a solitaire game, there's nothing you could really do except have a nice luck aspect to throw that randomness in there.
Jumping off topic a little bit, but responding to what you're saying there, there are very, very, very few games out there that do not involve some sort of luck.
Right.
There's this line of thinking, well, if there are no dice involved, there isn't any luck. Well, no, that's not right.
No.
Because, for an example, if you need to draw a tile of some sort, if you need to draw a card, anything where there's a randomized system, there is luck involved. Chess, okay, no luck. Go, no luck. Anything like that where it's always the same starting situation, those are games of skill. But I think that you see a lot of people talk about games, reviewers and things like that, and they focus on this, well, you know, there's just way too much luck involved in this game. 99.9% of the games out there have some form of luck involved.
Yes.
That's the toughest thing as far as solitaire games, and that's one of the reasons why the States of Siege system works so well. And every one of the games is different. There's always some tweaks.
Oh, yeah, I know.
You know, Keep Up the Fire, Dawn of the Zeds, Lost Cause, We Must Tell the Emperor, the upcoming Malta game, the World War II game that's going to be one of their States of Siege. Mm-hmm. They're not the same. It's not the same exact system. The only thing that they share is that there are some sort of tracks where your enemy is going to move along. It's very, very difficult to program an AI for a board game. That's the toughest thing to do. And that's the thing that takes the longest for game designers to put together. It's one thing to be able to say, okay, all of my players are human beings. Every side is represented by a person. All I have to do is tweak the balance, the gameplay. If you don't have an AI that acts rationally and hopefully is somewhat historically accurate, especially, you know, of course, in a historical game, then there's no point.
Exactly. Although I do think that there is it is possible to have too much luck in a game.
Correct.
I mean, if you don't have enough strategic elements also built into it to balance out the luck factors, you're just playing Uno with your kids.
Oh, yeah, you're right on the money, because if I'm playing something that's supposed to have some sort of strategic element to it, and it doesn't matter what I do, all it matters is the dice that I would roll or the cards that I would get or anything like that, that's a big turnoff. You get the feeling that you're not making any kind of impact on the game
itself.
Right,
it's only fate.
Right, monkeys could play it.
My next review is Space Empires 4X from GMT.
3X?
No, it's actually 4X.
And what do those X's represent?
for explore, expand, exploit, and exterminate. It was designed by Jim Crone, and it came out in 2011. For 1 to 4 players, takes about 2 to 3 hours to play, ages 12 and up. Speaking of the Space Empire building type games, which we did mention earlier.
Which you dig?
I do dig them.
Yeah, so do I dig them. You know what's funny? When you're talking about the 4X and I ask you what it represents, it reminds me of, remember the episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000 and it's Rocket Ship XM? It's Rocket Ship XM for Exploration Moon or whatever. And Crow goes, since when did that start with an X? Love that show. Love that show.
They got a lot of them up on Netflix now. I've been checking them out. Space Empires 4X is an empire building and conquest war game. There are a lot of galaxy domination games on the market, but Space Empires has some innovation built into it to distinguish it from the other games in the pack. The conquest part is the object of the game, as the way to win is by destroying your opponent's home world in most of the scenarios.
Yes!
The empire building part is simply the means to accomplish the conquest. The components consist of a mounted map board covered with large space hexes. Hundreds of chits, player reference sheets, a player's aid pad for tracking your empire, and 4 10-sided dice. The rulebook and the scenario book are both well done, although there were some questions that came up when I was playing it, and when I tried to find the answers, I saw that GMT had released an updated PDF of both the rulebook and the scenario book, and all the answers to the questions that I had were in there.
I think we had the same questions, too.
The first step is to select a scenario appropriate for the number of players. There's a lot of different ways to play in the scenario book, so you shouldn't have a problem there. In general, each player will select a color and a home world to play with. Following the map set up in the scenario book, all of a player's space counters are placed face down in a random fashion in their area of space. The area between the players is filled with deep space chits, and those are also face down. The reverse of the chits, when explored, will reveal what is located in that hex of space. In your home space, your chits usually contain worlds that you can colonize or minerals that you can mine. Deep space is a lot more dangerous, with a greater mix of black holes, supernovas, and danger chits, which mean instant destruction to the exploring ship. In this way, each game is different, as you need to send out ships to explore the hexes, which of course are random in every game. I really like the exploration factor. Finding a planet on your first turn can put you just a little bit ahead of your neighbors, well, at least for that first turn. You get a number of ships to start the game, and they're located at your home world. There are scouts, mining ships, colony ships, and shipyards to start you off. The game centers around the production of construction points. These are used to produce more ships and to purchase technologies to strengthen your empire. The first few turns, you'll be sending out your scouts to explore the space around you. When you reveal planets or minerals, you'll send your mining and your colony ships out to do their stuff. Now, after every third movement turn, an economic phase occurs. This is where you pull out your player aid tracking sheet and you get introduced to some of the bookkeeping that you need to do during the game. This is where you add up all of your current construction points from colonies and mineral acquisitions, subtract your maintenance costs, and use the remaining funds to purchase ships and technologies. You can save CPs from turn to turn if you need to.
I thought that was a nice wrinkle.
It is pretty cool because you can save up to get a lot of stuff later on.
A lot of games out there, it's sort of like if you don't use something in a turn, it's gone. Sometimes it doesn't make a lot of sense.
No. Like, what did you... Well, we didn't use this metal, so we're just going to shove it off into space.
Because we couldn't use it.
There's 12 different types of combat ships that you can produce. Your ability to produce them is based on your technology level, the size of your shipyards, and the amount of CPs that you have to spend. Each ship has an attack strength, a defense strength, an assigned attack sequence letter from A to E. A fires first, E fires last, and a hull size. The hull size will determine the amount of hits a ship can take before it's destroyed. Early in the game, you'll only be able to build the most basic types of ships until your technology level improves. One of the great things about building your ships is that you can build groups of ships, up to 6 in a group, and they're represented by a face-down chit, with another counter under it showing the number of ships that are in that group. So in this way, as you move across the board towards your enemy, they can't tell what is coming, or how many ships there are in that group. In this way, the players have to deal with the fog of war. You can even build decoy ships to spook your opponents into looking left when the real attack is coming from the right. The groups of ships that you can build make up the other bookkeeping aspect of the game. The reverse of the economic tracking sheet is the ship group tracking sheet. You are limited by the number of counters available as to what you can build for your empire. The age sheet will track the current levels of each group of ships. You'll need this because you can research advancements in attack, defense, movement, and tactics, thus improving the strengths of your ships. They do not get automatic upgrades. You will need to spend a turn at a shipyard to upgrade your older ships to the newer technology level. It is possible to avoid the whole ship tracking aspect of the game. There's an optional rule that says you can have ships automatically upgraded every time you learn a new technology, which completely eliminates the need to keep track of it on the aid sheet at all. I do like keeping track of it, though. I think it adds to the theme to have to dock in order to get your upgrades.
Yeah.
Now, one more word about the bookkeeping. It's done with a pen and pencil on the tracking sheets. If you don't like it, then you may not like the game. I'm not huge on a bunch of bookkeeping myself, but I really found it enjoyable in this case. Kind of along the lines of, like, B-17.
I didn't think it was just way out of hand either.
Kind of reminded me of, like, an expanded Roll Through the Ages tracking sheet, which I like a lot, you know?
Sure, yeah.
The nice thing is that all the players do the economic phase on the tracking sheet simultaneously, so that really cuts down on the downtime. Everybody's doing all that at the same time. Combat's fairly simple. You move into a hex with enemy units and a battle happens. Players flip over their counters, revealing the strength and the number of ships. The counters are set aside in order of firing sequence based on their rating from A to E. You take the strength of the attacker minus the defense of the defender, and rolling under or equal the resulting number on a 10-sided die is a hit. Each ship in the group fires and each takes hits. As ships are destroyed, they're removed, and combat continues until the enemy is eliminated. Or they retreat. Thus, the game continues until one player manages to destroy the homeworld of the other player, which signifies victory. This covers most of the basic rules. There's lots more that you can add when you want to, like there's carriers and fighter squadrons, merchant routes, point defense against fighters, there's raiders, cloaking, scanners, mines, minesweepers, alien races, war points.
My head's gonna explode!
There's enough there for you to make it as strategic as you wish. Plus, there's more additional optional rules to add to the realism if you want. I am having a great time playing Space Empires 4X. A special note about the solitaire game, there are two included scenarios versus aliens and doomsday machines.
Yep.
These are excellent, and they are not easy. I had almost as much fun playing the solitaire scenario as I had with the multiplayer ones. The game rules are not difficult, and you can add or subtract the advanced rules as you wish for your gaming group. You know, it's funny, on the first Doomsday one that I played, you get a few turns before the Doomsday machine shows up and starts gobbling towards your home world.
Yep.
Then they start coming out one after, you know, you only get a turn in between each one near the end. You're like, oh man.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was doing. My neighbors wonder what the hell's going on.
The variability and exploration factors added to the many different paths you can take towards your conquest, and it's excellent. It's now one of my favorite sci-fi conquest games, and I'm really looking forward to getting a game in against my older son, Brian, who of course beats me at pretty much everything.
Yes.
But a very good game, very good.
I've played the solitaire missions, and it's funny, you know, the Doomsday, I always think of Fred Saberhagen's Berserker stories. Talking old sci-fi, well, not that old sci-fi, late 70s, I think, mid-late 70s. Yeah. I love GMT. I really do. And I opened this one up, and I was kind of, you know, looking through the rules and stuff, and I thought, ooh, I don't know if I'm going to like this. It was weird. I was just flipping through the rules, and I'm like, oh, geez, yeah, I don't know. And then I was like, man, yeah, this is great.
Yeah, it was really cool. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the Planet Eater from the original Star Trek episode. That's what the Doomsday Machines make me think of.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, exactly. It's funny because a lot of people think GMT, it's always only war games and a real grognard kind of stuff. And that's not the case. They've got so many games out there if you look beyond the appearance of it, just because it's hexes and counters and things like that doesn't necessarily mean it's just going to be your traditional Avalon Hill / SPI kind of game. And I think a lot of people are selling themselves short when they don't take a much closer look at what's out there from GMT.
Yeah, they do have some good stuff. Well, Dominant Species,
Yeah, exactly. Dominant Species. Come on. Twilight Struggle,
baby. Oh, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, let's get real here. Fighting Formations, yeah, it's a Chad Jensen design, kind of traditional war game, but a lot of Euro kind of influence to it. Chad Jensen has a new game coming out very soon, Urban Sprawl, that I really want to take a look at.
Oh, yeah, I saw that one. That does look good.
Yeah, I'm hearing good stuff about that. Yeah, I love GMT. Excellent, excellent games. And, of course, my next review is going to be a GMT title as well.
Sweet.
You know, Elliot, it is October, and October is always the month for Halloween. As I had mentioned earlier, we'll probably talk about some of our favorite horror games on our next show. But I did want to mention, if someone is out there looking for a great horror game that you can play solitaire, you can do absolutely no wrong by picking up Dawn of the Zeds from Victory Point Games. It is one of their States of Siege games. It is awesome. It is loads and loads of fun. It's not a war game. It's got a lot of narrative to it. It's simply a blast. Like a deathly hand from the grave comes Dawn of the Zeds. As I mentioned, a States of Siege solitaire game of horror and survival from designer Herman Luttman. The world has gone crazy. A deadly virus has turned ordinary people, just like you.
Me?
You! Into vicious zombie-like killers. These undead, called Zeds, are now converging on your corner of the world.
Mine?
Yours! Left to your own devices while the National Guard twiddles its thumbs, doing whatever, and organizing a relief column to fight its way to you, how long will you survive? Regular citizens can emerge as heroes as you work to halt the Zed's advances by, I don't know, re-killing them? Discovering and implementing a cure to the vile scourge and preserving the area and its inhabitants as much as possible. Be the
brains
behind the operation. Fight the hordes and protect your town people. It's a game that will keep you on your toes, although you might lose a few. Unearth the possibilities with Dawn of the Zeds, a nightmare that ends with your fate ranging between being a hero or a hero sandwich. You can order Dawn of the Zeds at victorypointgames.com.
Cool.
You need to play the copy that I sent you. It's it's my own personal copy. I gave it to you, man, because I knew you would like it.
I know I will. I just haven't had a chance to get it on the table yet.
My friend, I am right with you. Jeez, you know what we should do?
What?
We should quit our day jobs and just play games full time. And you know what? Let's get rid of all of our family members, too.
Right. Yeah, I just play games.
Yeah. So what do you do, man? I play games. What, with people's heads? No, man. I mean, you know, games. Board games.
This just in.
What, are you getting a news update? Our last review is yet another GMT release. It is Son of York, designed by Mike Nagel. It was originally released in 2005, but not by GMT. It was a desktop published game at that point. It has just recently come out from GMT, and it is a card game for two players, and suggested ages are, they say 8 and up, but I would honestly say probably 12 or 13.
30 and up.
It is very, very mature material. Honestly, for most Americans, the multitude of conflicts that have taken place over the centuries involving England can be a bit confusing. The Hundred Years' War, the Anarchy, the 80 Years' War, so forth, they can cause plenty of folks, especially those with a more America-centric knowledge of history, to kind of scratch our heads. The Wars of the Roses, the subject of GMT's Son of York, may also be a bit obscure for our regular listeners, but I'm sure a lot of our grognard listeners will probably have a pretty good handle on the subject. Before I really get into the review itself, let me say that the title of the game is not a misprint. I've been seeing a lot of people posting that the title is not correct. It's Son, S-U-N, of York. And they're saying, oh, GMT messed up. It's supposed to be Son, S-O-N, of York. But that's not correct. The reality is the title's derived from the opening lines of William Shakespeare's Richard III. Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this Son of York. And all the clouds that lord upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean buried. And it is Son, S-U-N.
Great. Now I got to go change all those blog posts I made.
Yeah, nice going. For those who don't know, the Wars of the Roses were a series of civil wars fought for the throne of England between supporters of two rival branches of the Royal House of Plantagenet. These rivals were the houses of Lancaster and York. The symbol of the Lancastrians was a red rose, while the Yorkists' color of rose was white, and thus the name of these wars. A great deal of the fighting took place between 1455 and 1485, although there were some battles both before and after this period. And the winner of the fight was the House of Tudor. Go wiki that up. With that mighty brief background out of the way, let's take a look at the game itself. It's a GMT release, so we know it's going to be nicely presented. The components that we're in store for are going to be what we always see from GMT. Included in the box are two 110-card decks, one for the House of Lancaster and the other, obviously, for the House of York, and a rulebook. The rulebook itself is well-written and includes a pretty extensive example of play. The cards themselves represent army units, leaders, terrain, and special effects. The army units can range from simple levies, which are really no more than cannon fodder, to mounted knights, and everything in between. Although I have to point out there are a lot of longbowmen, which really doesn't seem very historically accurate. There's no map for your battles, as you mentally mark out a 3-square by 3-square grid in which combat is going to take place. The main area is divided into left, center, and right battles for each side. And that's actually how they referred to these locations during that period of time. You also have flanking areas to each side. Combat doesn't occur there, but you can move combat units into flanking positions. It's a really nice concept, and I think Mike Nagel did a nice job here. The victory conditions of the game, pretty simple. You can win by either capturing your enemy's rear center battle position or capturing both of your enemy's rear flank battle positions. One of the key areas in the game that most people will kind of have a little bit of a hard time wrapping their head around is as these units take hits, if they fall back, if they retreat, all those hits fall off. So they completely recover. So the trick isn't necessarily destroying these units, because once they do retreat, it's really tough to get them back into the fight.
Really?
Sort of, yeah. It took a minute to kind of wrap my head around this, because normally you would think, okay, well, if I retreat, I'm still having taken losses. The way this game plays is when your units retreat, it's very, very difficult to get them to actually commit to the battle once again. So, in effect, you're doing the same exact thing as knocking them out. It plays pretty fast. It's an interesting game, although I do have some quibbles with it. Not hugely, because I'm looking at this as a game. I've seen some people who are talking about the game and really concerned with the historical inaccuracies and so forth. And there are quite a few. There are 18 scenarios that do come with the game. And some of the battles that are presented really are completely one-sided or really nothing exciting. They were very, very minor in the big scope of things. Mm-hmm. One side's the attacker, the other's the defender, and supposedly historically it was the exact opposite and so forth. I look at this as a game. It's not a historical simulation by any stretch of the imagination whatsoever. And another thing to keep in mind is that there isn't a lot of really reliable info about this period. Remember, we're talking about the 15th century here.
No, wait, let me get my book.
Okay, there you want me to hang it?
Sure. 15th century, let's see, Son of York. No, all they have is S.O. Wan.
Are you editing your posts again?
Yeah.
There are some issues as far as some of the cards that are not included. There are some leaders, their cards aren't included, but the actual battles are. Now, I understand that you can go and download these additional cards that you can print out. But if you could print out the cards, then why are you going to GMT to buy the game?
Right.
You know, I mean, honestly, if I could get the desktop published version of it. Plus, I also sit there and I think, okay, I've got this great looking game. I've got these really nice decks of cards. Now I'm going to print up something to include with that. A little odd. But here's the whole thing. The game's a lot of fun. The game is a blast. Is it historically recreating these battles? No, it's kind of rigid. You don't have a lot of maneuverability as far as what your units are doing. But I think it's a fun game if you look at it as a game and not as a simulation. Is Son of York a perfect game? No. It's accessible. It's well designed for the most part. There's a few things that I kind of scratch my head about. But as you had mentioned with GMT releasing the updated rules, because they believe in living rules, that you can download, you know,
yeah,
different changes and things like that. As I said, it's not a very easy period for somebody to design a game about. That's why there aren't a whole lot of games that are set in this period, or basically about the Wars of the Roses. Something like this hasn't been done before. I think it's a fun game. If you're looking for a nice kind of card-based battle game that you can finish up in about 2 hours, and does have a lot of historical flavor and theme to it, definitely pick up Son of York. If you're someone who's looking to simulate the Wars of the Roses, then I would say maybe not up your alley.
Might have to invent a time machine and actually just go back.
That's exactly it. Oh, you guys had this all wrong.
Look at all these longbowmen.
I didn't realize there were so many. I hope you brought gum for everyone. So I was waiting for you to jump in on that one. All right, so I guess that's the end of the show, huh?
Yeah. Okay, bye, everybody.
All right, we have one last piece of business to take care of, to announce the winner of the Gaming Gang Birthday Bash Contest.
Just
a recap. One lucky person is going to walk away with all of this great swag. Elliot, you want to start?
Yep. First, we're going to have Nightfall and Martial Law from AEG. Sweet.
Yes, we have Small World Underground from Days of Wonder.
Gears of War, the board game from Fantasy Flight Games.
No Retreat, the Russian Front from GMT.
Crappy Birthday from North Star Games.
Word on the Street from Out of the Box Publishing.
Square Shooters from the Square Shooters guys.
Isn't it Heartland
Productions?
It's Heartland something like that, yeah. Telestrations from USAopoly.
Dawn of the Zeds from Victory Point Games. Cool.
See? Hey, so there you go. Somebody's going to win that so they can ignore the little commercial earlier. They don't have to buy it. Core Worlds from Stronghold Games.
Bloodsuckers from Fireside Games.
Identic from Asmodee Editions.
And from Crafty Games, the hottest new RPG released this winter, Mistborn.
Woohoo! Loads and loads of goodies. We're talking about altogether, it is 14 games. And We have selected the winner, and the winner is... E.M. Miller from Villa Park, Illinois.
Woo! I win!
Wait a second. What? Huh? That, something seems wrong here.
No.
E.M. Miller. Who the hell do I know without E.M.? Hey! I'm just kidding. Elliot, would you care to announce the winner of the Gaming Gang birthday bash?
The winner is Brooks Child. Now, is that...
Brooks Child.
Is that a name or is that a email moniker?
No, that's their name.
Okay. Brooks Child from Virginia.
From Virginia. Well, we're guessing they're from Virginia because it's part of their email address. So they may not be from Virginia, but Brooks Child is the winner of the first annual. I don't know. Is it going to be an annual thing?
We'll see.
Just so, Brooks, you know, and hopefully you're listening, we are going to contact you by email so you can give us your address so we can forward it on to all of the companies that did participate in the contest. They are going to send out the games. It's important to keep in mind that Core Worlds from Stronghold Games, as well as Mistborn from Crafty Games, are not out yet. Once they are available, you will receive your copy. All right, man, that's
sweet.
A lot of
pretty
good
sweet.
Stuff. Well, like I said, we had over 1,000 people enter the contest. Now, I will point out, not all those people got all the answers right.
Only two
so,
did, right?
Yeah, E.M. Miller
and Brooks Child.
Yeah, right. No, actually, I would take a stab because as they were coming in, mm-hmm. I would check. And then if they were correct, they went into a special folder in my email. Off the top of my head, I think about 15% of the entries had incorrect answers. So unfortunately, as we had mentioned in the rules, if you didn't have the answers right, you couldn't win.
Wah, wah.
All right, so that should be it for the show yep. this time around, unless you have anything you'd like to add.
Nope, I'm
nope,
cool,
you're
man.
Good? Cool is the other side of the pillow. All right, then, Elliot, why don't you take us out?
You've been listening to the Gaming Gang Podcast with Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller. If you'd like to know more about the topics or games we discussed in this episode, please visit our website at www.thegaminggang.com. If you would like to have your opinion heard or have a gaming issue you'd like us to discuss on a future podcast, you can visit the Gaming Gang Guild on BoardGameGeek or call us at 480-779-7365 and leave a message. If you enjoyed listening to our podcast, please rate us on iTunes. Some of the games discussed on our show were provided to the Gaming Gang in the form of review copies. On behalf of everyone here at the Gaming Gang, thanks for listening.